evening, and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Happy Shabbat to one and all. Well, we finally learned the truth. Confronted by a genuine blowhard, our friend Larry is genuinely blown away. Larry lives in Jacksonville, Florida. We shouldn't be joking about this, I guess, but it is Matthew, Yah's gift, that is menacing the Florida coast, now about ready to leave Florida, Jacksonville, the far north part of Florida. The eye is just off Jacksonville as we're speaking. And Larry has moved inland to avoid the storm surge, I would assume, and also the high winds in the Jacksonville area. As it moves up the coast of Georgia, towards Savannah, and the islands off the Georgian coast. We would also have Jacobin Island, Jekyll Island. The Jacobins are, of course, those that started the French Revolution based upon Weishaupt's Order of the Illumes. But and so they certainly gave a set of precedents for that which was done on Jekyll Island. The Jekyll Island is one of those low-lying islands that's feeling the storm surge and the brunt of Hurricane Matthew as we speak. So it is it's a big storm, I guess. It's still a Category 2, and the tide is now rising. One of the things that we're approaching, depending on when you determine the first month of the year, you know, for those of us who celebrated Pesach early, based upon the timing of what we thought was the first of Abib versus what others assumed was the first of Abib. Teruah and Yom Kippurim and Sukkah are now past for those who took the later time. It is still future. And Kirk, we talked a little bit about Yom Kippurim in the afternoon observations program, but it probably behooves us to repeat some of that here. And I have no issue with someone taking exception to this. Kirk, feel free to do so. I came to the conclusion that the first four mikre were fulfilled because they enable the benefits of the covenant, not only for Yisrael, but particularly for those of us who were adopted, Goyim, if you will, who were adopted into the covenant. And then Teruah is the day that we use those gifts to announce to the world at large, but mostly to Yisrael and Yehudim, that the path to Yahweh comes through not only the covenant, but through these seven Moed Mikre, and that those first four enable the fifth, and that the family that is benefits is almost it's not universally, but heavily oriented towards Goyim, who have been adopted into Yahweh's family, because the preponderance of Yehudim have rejected Yahweh. And of course, you know, the numbers have always been that Yisrael and Yehudim represent a tiny fraction of 1% of the earth's population. And so while they'll be, I would assume, the majority of those who are part of the covenant family, prior to reconciliations, they could well be, even if a higher percentage per capita of them become part of the covenant by 100-fold, they would still, in raw numbers, be fewer than us Goyim. And so I look
I'm
at
not,
the...
I'm not sure how it not happened. Had it not happened that way, there may not be many Goyim at all.
That's correct.
I mean, we know in the fourth year all that had to happen anyway. That's the prophecy. However, the simple fact is that's kind of the time when the Goyim would hear it. I mean, by the time we get to reconciliations, he's reconciling with Yehudim and Yisrael.
When Adam and Chawa left the garden, had their relationship with Yahweh resonated with those outside the garden, it'd be, you know, things would be radically different if more people had decided that they were going to board the Ark of the Covenant with Noah and his family. Things would have been markedly different. And then at the time of Moshe, if Egypt had listened to Yahweh's request, you know, things would have been entirely different. But even in the time of that the Torah was being revealed, the Israelites were told expressly that any goyim, any foreigner that was living among mm-hmm. them who wished to be adopted into the family, there was one Torah for them, one covenant for them, one Pesach for all, and we were all welcome. Now, we had to leave the ways of the Gentiles to be part of the family, and we had to come to Israel from a attitude, perspective point of view, but we were welcome. But of course, most Israel rejected Yahweh, but the covenant promises had to be fulfilled. Yosha came in year 4000 Yah to enable those first four Moed Mikre. They have been fulfilled, which enables the covenant's five benefits. Then we tell that story on Teruah, on trumpets. And I think that the vast preponderance of those telling the story on trumpets are Goyim. And mm-hmm. if they're not Goyim, then they're Yehudim and Israelites who are estranged from their Israelite brethren have been adopted into the family nonetheless.
Yes.
And what we're doing is essentially encouraging Israel and Yehudah to do as Yahweh is encouraging, which is to come together as one and then be reconciled back with Yahweh. And the reason we're talking about this, too, is that if that perception is correct, then the Day of Reconciliations has very little to do with us Goyim who've been adopted into Yahweh's family. It doesn't mean we don't celebrate it. We celebrate it in anticipation of his return and his reconciliation with Israel. We celebrate it as individuals with the opportunity to play a role in making that day as fruitful, as enjoyable as absolutely possible. But I think what we're celebrating is not our own reconciliation, because that took place at Pesach Bukurim, or Pesach Matzah Bukurim and Shavuah, and we've been touting the message on Teruah of reconciliation. We're already reconciled. So we're not celebrating our reconciliation. We're celebrating Israel's reconciliation. Now, that being the case, that means that every celebration of reconciliation up to the time that Yahweh returns on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, October 2nd, sundown, 6:20 p.m. Jerusalem time, in 2033 Roman pagan calendar. Until that time, there really is no reason to call it a feast. We're not going to celebrate until the family is reconciled. You know, with the story of the prodigal son, which we were told, which is a microcosm of this,
mm-hmm.
when did the father throw the feast?
When he returned.
Returned.
Yeah.
Right. Did the father say, you know what I think I'm going to do is while my son is gone for the next 10 years in anticipation of his return, let's have a feast? No.
No.
And so
sense.
I think that if you look at the celebration of Yom Kippurim, it is a celebration of what will transpire, and therefore there's no reason for a feast until Yahweh returns, and when he returns, he's going to provide the feast.
Hmm.
Now, that is not to say it's a fast, because it isn't, but
no.
There's no prescribed menu for the specific purpose. There's no reason to celebrate a feast until his family is reconciled to him. They're between now and 2033, they're still estranged. Now, for those who choose to fast, I'm telling you, I think you're influenced. In fact, I know you'd be influenced by religious skullduggery in this case. Yahweh does not ask us to fast. And he is a superb communicator. And if he does not ask us to fast, he does not want us to fast, because if he wanted us to fast, he would instruct us to fast. He's really good at that stuff.
Yeah. Now, there's nothing in there that even remotely resembles fasting.
Correct. Now, there's a lot of things that Yahweh doesn't provide comprehensive, unambiguous instructions. You know, like the when is the day that we should be celebrating? You know, many of us celebrate a month earlier than the rest of, because there is no definitive way really to determine when is the first of Abib. There are some years, it's not often, but there are some years where the new moon is fairly equidistant from the vernal equinox, which is the most, kind of the average time when barley would be Abib. And so we don't have really concrete instructions there. God doesn't say, you know, it's got to be a sliver of the renewing light on the moon that is beyond 3%, so somebody with less than 20/20 vision would notice it, that it has to be the new moon has
visible
to have,
from this spot and this
right,
time.
You know, and, you know, like our one of the NASA issues is that it might show that the first sliver of light on the moon occurs on a certain day. But that's because our day is different than the Hebrew day. Our day ends at midnight. That day ends at sunset, and sometimes sunset, like in the wintertime, might be at 4:30. And so you've got 7.5 hours until midnight. And I mean, I just assume that if the first light on the moon's surface occurred after sunset, it doesn't count, because that would be the next day.
That's right.
But there's no specific instruction there. It doesn't say you ought not calculate. It doesn't say, you know, when weather patterns change and there's not a large barley crop and you're not living in an agrarian culture and you don't have barley sitting outside of your doorstep that you can check to see when it's Abib, when it's still green and growing but not yet matured, that the first beginning of light on the moon's surface at that time, you know, it doesn't say, you know, boy, you know, if you live in Alaska, and that's really, barley is not going to become a Abib in Alaska until, you know, 3 months later. He doesn't provide that kind of instruction. But he gives you enough that if you're thoughtful about it, we're going to agree on the right month 95% of the time. We're going
to
agree.
And if you really don't know what to do, I was going to say, if you really don't know what to do, you just do it twice.
There you go. That's fine. And, you know, the other thing is that on the specific day within that month, you know, whether or not there's enough light on the surface of the moon to justify that being the Kodesh that he is speaking about in terms of renewable light, we're only going to be different by a day. And I don't think Yahweh is all that concerned that we are precise in our timing, because it's not about precision in doing. It is about understanding. And understanding is an ongoing process. It is never complete. It is, understanding is really never even precise. It's ongoing. It's always improving. It's kind of like calculus, where you're constantly trying to hone in on an ever more accurate estimate. That's kind of what understanding is. And so, you know, that's the reason I think Yahweh provides us with the instructions that way. But he'll never go so far as to not mention something and expect you to do it. So if he does not say fast, he most certainly isn't expecting you too fast.
Hmm. Can I ask you a quick question?
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to say, the other part of the question is that All right, I'm sorry, I interrupted you again.
No, go ahead. I'll ask you later.
I was just going to say the second part of it is that that a day of reconciliations is a celebration. Again, the parable of the prodigal son, when the son returned, they didn't have a, oh, woe is you, you're such a scumbag, why were you gone all that time? No, it was a party, it was a celebration. And Yom Kippurim is a celebration of the return of the prodigal's child. And so it is a celebration. It is not a time to afflict one's soul. The anah, which is rendered afflict, its primary meaning is to answer and respond. That's something that Yahweh specifically wants us to do. In fact, I had a similar word that can have a dark and light side. Jeff and I were corresponding. We were talking about halal, which is the primary word that is translated, rendered prayer in most English Bibles. And the basis of the word is to provide a thoughtful response, a thoughtful answer to communicate after exercising good judgment. So there's a lot of Hebrew words like that, and that is the basis of anah in this particular case. So what I think we're doing with Yom Kippurim is we're celebrating the return and the reuniting of Yahweh with His chosen people, with His first family. And this passage we're about to consider is going to talk about those of us who are the goyim who have participated in Teruah being there to witness it. So go ahead now, Kirk, please.
No, I was just thinking about the... it's always bothered me that he's reconciling with Yisrael and Yehudim. Yisrael was led by Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph. Joseph was really on board. How did they fall off the track so bad? I mean, Yehudim stuck around a long time, even though they all fell off, you know. As we
did. The real tremendous separation between Yisrael and Yehuda, of course, is presented in Hosha, where Hosha is asked to marry Gomer, a temple prostitute, and the condemnations against Ephraim, and Ephraim is symbolic of all the tribes with exception of Yehuda. And so it is, God just says, you are not my people. I am not your God. Based upon you having an adulterous relationship with other gods, our relationship is hereby over. It will one day be reconciled, and he talks about in 2 days and then on the third day, speaking of the timing of all of that. And he says specifically, you know, I'm not at this point divorcing myself of Yehuda, and that was specifically because Yehuda had to deliver Yosha for the express purpose of fulfilling the first four Moed Mikre. That's the time that it was all announced.
Yeah. It just always struck me they were so close.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know,
fell off the wagon. Like,
yeah, when you read Yeshayah, Isaiah, it is a universal condemnation of Yisrael and of Yehuda. At that point, you know, God is really, and a lot of it's prophetic, speaking of future dates, but He is really condemning of the religion that they had had established.
Well, I always shocked at how much the USA comes in this stuff too.
I think at one point he calls them Oholiba and Oholibama, and it's not a very flattering term.
No, it's
yes, hello.
Yeah,
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, yeah. Yeah, he is, in Yeshayah, he is not the least bit pleased with them. He says that essentially you are, you're sick from the sole of your foot to the top of your head. There is nothing that is saying in you, you have menstrual cramps of the brain. and have ceased to be thoughtful and functional, and is essentially calling them deadbeat morons that were have
yes,
no value whatsoever.
Yes, well, if you've ever been to Yom Kippurim in a synagogue, you'd completely understand what he's talking about. what an affair. Oh,
yeah,
it is a snooze fest, really. It's disgusting. It's absolute filth.
You know, it's almost like the Pesach celebration in rabbinic Judaism. You know, it is a historic celebration. It has nothing to do with eternal life.
I think it's perfect. I think their feasts are absolute perfection. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
What do they have on their Pesach plate? A bunch of symbols and a lamb bone. You don't get to eat no lamb. You just get a lamb bone. That's all you get. It proves how much they hate him. Come on now. All you have to do is look at the plate. You're going to be starving, okay?
Yeah,
you have no lamb. You don't get through the door.
It's perfect, but from the perspective of perfectly exposing the nature of the corrupt religion.
Perfectly rebellious.
Yes. Yeah, and of course,
take Yom Kippur.
Yeah, that they celebrate Pesach as a historic commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt, and they have no concept as to why Pesach is celebrated in conjunction with an Exodus. We're saying that if you're going to be part of my family, you're going to leave the human family. You're going to leave the power of religion and politics and militarism and all of those kinds of things behind. And I'm going to walk with you away from those things, because those things are deadly, and life is found apart from them. We have a...
Well, it's perfect. We're still eating the leeks and Mithraim in Egypt, you know? We like that stuff. We love our slavery. We thrive on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's...
Take Yom Kippur. Do you know how absurd? They just sit around and cry and teshuvah and this and that and Moshe Rabbeinu and please forgive us and weigh our hearts in the balance. It's a joke. It's absolutely a farce. It's a circus.
You know, if you actually know the terms and conditions and the benefits of the covenant, one thing you never ask God for is forgiveness. If you actually know Yahweh and His plan, you never ask.
Oh no, I think it's perfect. They do this every year.
Yeah.
I think it's perfect.
If you're begging,
Christians do it every day. Almost
course,
every meal.
Christians do it every day.
I'm talking about hours and hours and hours of Tehillim, Tehillim, come, Teshuvah, you know, get your name written in the book, whatever. It's insanity. It's absolute insanity. And it's 10 hours, you know that, right? It's like 10 hours of total insanity.
Of deprivation.
And starvation. Did I mention the starvation? You know?
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's the...
How could you hear anything over your stomach?
Are they at all aware of the root of Kippurim? Of what the word means?
Yes.
Do they know that
They're so rote in their tradition. It's become...
Well, they're aware.
Like second skin they wear. It's like a Purim mask, you know? It's just something they put on for a day or two and they go back to their life.
So they recognize that the word means to reconcile, and they are there's a disconnect that when you reconcile a relationship, you do not starve yourself, you do not afflict yourself, you do not slap yourself silly. If you reconcile a relationship, you celebrate that relationship.
No, we can't think for ourselves. We can do science, we can do math, but we cannot think for ourselves because the rabbis will do that for us.
Well, I know that is the rabbinic claim, is that the Torah cannot be understood by mere mortals, and that the rabbis, who are the exalted ones, must explain it. And of course, they don't ever explain.
But even the
Karaites, the Yahweh's Torah,
they don't use the Talmud.
They only explain their Torah, which is the Talmud.
Yeah. But even
they don't
know, right?
They don't know Yahweh's Torah. They know their Torah.
Yeah, for sure. I posted a video of four Jews, and somebody asked them, what do you study for, like, 10 hours a day? All four of them chime in. The Talmud, and I was just, like, busted out laughing. Of course.
Yeah.
If you knew Torah, your Talmud would be worthless as toilet paper.
Yeah, and that's why it's so funny when you tell somebody, somebody will say, you're going to celebrate Christmas or Easter, and says, no, I don't celebrate religious holidays. I actually mourn religious holidays. I am not religious. I am instead Torah observant. And they said, oh, then you're Jewish. And you want to know, that's silly. And to say, there isn't a religious Jew on the planet that is Torah observant.
No,
when they say they're Torah observant, what they mean is that they're Talmud
observant. Oh, not religious, yeah.
There is not a single religious Jew on the planet that is Torah observant.
Impossible.
All religious Jews are Talmud observant.
And there isn't a single rabbi who's ever seen the Shamayim, ever, and ever will.
Right. That is correct.
And I want to just make that clear because there's Jews out there listening for the first time.
Or Pope, whoever will.
No, none of them. None of them.
No. It is true that Yahweh's condemnation of religion as it's practiced in Israel, and all of it in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is of a Babylonian variety. Rabbinic Judaism did not exist throughout any of the time that the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms were being written. So what he's condemning Jews for their religion throughout it, and it's ubiquitous, he is condemning them for accepting the Babylonian Gentile religions.
Throwing bread to the fish? You know, like they used to do in Babylon? After Yom Kippur? You mean like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Weeping for Tammuz. How about that one? Celebrating the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God.
The original cake, the 40-layer cake to the Queen of Heaven.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was heartbreaking. That really was baklava.
Weeping for Tammuz. It was a common practice. It is. So, while that is true, that's because Yisrael and Yahudim are his chosen people. But apart from that, the second most condemned religion, and actually of religions that are practiced today, overwhelmingly the most condemned is Christianity. Because while there is copious condemnations of Yisrael for being religious, the religion that they were practicing at the time, religions, none of those are practiced by in Israel today. Today, the religion is Rabbinic Judaism, and Rabbinic Judaism didn't really begin until the 2nd century BCE. And so the only condemnation of it is actually by Yosha. And so the religion that is practiced today that gets by far the most condemnation, Christianity, Pauline Christianity, where Yahweh calls it the plague of death, because it has actually killed far more people. There's 5 billion people who have succumbed to Pauline Christianity. But, you know, there's a lot of commonality, of course, in Pauline Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism, and that Paul was
There's
a
commonality
rabbi.
Between all three of them, really.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, it's the direct links between Islam and either Christianity and Judaism are a little shallower in one respect and deeper in another. Muhammad's, unlike Paul was a fairly bright guy. I don't mean bright in a positive sense, but he wasn't, he was... he could read, he could write,
he was a schemer, he was a hustler,
he was a well-educated schemer. Muhammad was dumb as a stone. And so after Muhammad created the first probably 30 or 40 surahs simply by plagiarizing Hanif poetry, that would be the poetry of the pagans in Yemen. After he ran that well dry, because it was pretty thin, the only hope that he had left to even approximate credibility was to pay rabbis in Yathrib, today's Medina, to recite their Talmud to him.
Now, Talmud, yeah.
He thought that the stories that they were telling were out of the Torah, but they weren't. They were the Babylonian Talmud was compiled in writing around 500 CE, and Muhammad came about 100 years thereafter, and so they were reciting Talmud stories to him.
It's obvious. The two verses in the Talmud and the Quran are worded exactly the same.
Exactly the same. Huge swaths are worded exactly the same, and there are, and the Quran even says that the Jews sold him these stories, and that Muhammad didn't like having to pay them for them, and that and then it says that the reason really that the Jews had to be killed is because they threatened to expose Muhammad and said, come on, these surahs that you're
and that he paid too much.
that he paid too much for them, and then they said, come on, you're pretending like just these surahs that you're revealing have been inspired by some god, and all you're doing is taking the stories that we have told you, you're bastardizing them, you're twisting them to serve your own agenda, and we're going to
but even more, he paid too much. Have you ever tried to argue with an Arab at the shuk?
that's why there is so much of the Talmud
there's Vedic poetry Christian poetry as well.
There is very little Christianity there because Muhammad did not have contact with any Christian other than a possibility that there was one, and he managed to bastardize those stories to the point that they're not even remotely credible. But his last couple of surahs make because he had overhunted Jews, there were no more Jews to rape or plunder, and so after overhunting Jews after Kabar, when the Allahu Akbar phrase was first created, Allahu Akbar means that Allah is greater than Yahweh, greater than the God of the Jews who had been expelled from Yathrib.
I disagree. I think Allah Akbar means Allah's a gangster. That's what I think.
I appreciate the fact that that it is true that Islam was created as a mobster concept. That is, it was a criminal enterprise, and that the first official act of Islam in the first year of the Islamic era is what's called the Battle of Badr, and it is a mafia type raid against a business to rob it. And so it's clear that Islam was created as a criminal enterprise. So I will give you that. But I will tell you for certain, and you probably know this, that Allahu Akbar was first uttered the morning that Muhammad and his hooligans came upon Kabar, which were the Jews that had been exiled, the first of the three tribes in Yathrib were exiled. The next two were murdered. They had created a farming community in Kabar, and Muhammad, after he got cold feet on his first attempt to conquer Mecca, he had insufficient men under arms. He formed the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, where he said, I will not attack any Arab, particularly a Meccan, for 10 years. I won't I won't rape Meccans. I won't terrorize Meccans. I won't do anything. I won't rob Meccans for 10 years. His the mercenaries, the hooligans that he had with him, you know, only went down with him because they wanted to rape and plunder, and so they were looking for money and for sex and for blood, and so on the way back to satiate the those instincts of his the first Muslims, they went back to Yathrib by way of Kabar for the express purpose of giving the first Muslim someone to attack and to plunder. And so as Muhammad showed up with his gang outside of Kabar, they said, what do you want us to do? The Jews were coming out with their agricultural implements, and Muhammad was there with his men under arms. They said, what do you want us to tell them? And he said, Allahu Akbar. Allah is greater. Greater than whom? Well, that would be greater than the God of the Jews. So that's what Allah
which is exactly Hashatan's statement. Exactly what he wants. He wants to be Elohim, higher than.
That is correct. Oh, yeah. Once you understand what Allahu Akbar means and when it was first used and to whom it was spoken, you know, because when it says Allah is greater, if you're intelligent at all, you're going to say greater than whom? And it's, you know, Akbar means older, greater, bigger. Bigger than whom?
Well, Muslims still carry this intelligence to this day.
Predating whom. And so that would be your first question. Well, that would depend on who it was being spoken to, wouldn't it? So when you realize that it was spoken at Kabar, and that was a community of Jews, exclusively of Jews, then it is, in fact, the very statement that got Hasatan, Satan, thrown out of heaven. He wanted to be greater than the Most High, and that is what Allahu Akbar is his confession. It is, I mean, it is so obvious that Allah is Satan based on that alone, that if you're an educated, thoughtful individual, you cannot be a Muslim based on Allahu Akbar. It's just over. So that's the only Judaism that exists within Islam is the plagiarized passages from the Talmud. In Christianity, there really isn't a lot of Judaism, you know, because they have severed all affection for Jews, for Israel, for Jerusalem, for the Torah, for Hebrew. I mean, so they are as far from that as possible. So if you were to say, like when I tell people I'm not going to celebrate Easter, I'm going to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, Passover, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children. They said, well, you must be Jewish. Yahweh invited us to meet with him on these days. And he said he wanted us to meet with him on these days for all time. And they are the means to become part of his family. So, no, I'm just simply Torah observant by doing these things. And, you know, why would you
like
be celebrating Easter
follow
Babylonian?
His advice?
Yeah, you're saying that's a bad idea, and yet... Obviously, you must think it's a bad idea because you don't celebrate any of them. Oh, by the way, the guy that you think that is God in the flesh, he celebrated them.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
And
you claim that you follow him. How come you don't do what he did?
How can they follow their God anywhere? He's up on a stick and he's dead. Right?
Yeah, you know, and that is the most amazing thing is that, you continue to see... For example, there was this. I actually watched part of a funeral, and that is because I got to meet a number of times Arnold Palmer. I really liked Arnold Palmer. The times I met him, he was just the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. Now, Arnold Palmer's not in heaven, despite what they said in the funeral. He's not in hell either. But he was a really good guy. He's just not a covenant member. And in a church that I think was probably an Episcopal church, it looked like it was Roman Catholic light, they had this huge, huge crucifix. Their God just hanging there on that stick. Without debt. How in the world is the world's largest religion the celebration of God on a stick? You know, I don't know if you ever pay attention on the Comedy Channel. There's the ventriloquist that has the jalapeno on a stick. Yeah, well, he is a jalapeno on a stick. Yep, so far.
When Jews do not, like Christ on the
stick. Christianity, you know, I'm waiting for one of these days the jalapeno on a stick is going to say, you know, what is it like to be on a stick? Is it, well, you know, I should be worshipped because, you know, the most popular religion in the world has their God on a stick.
Yeah, it's very telling that Christianity's two most common depictions of their Jesus Christ is either him helpless hanging on the cross or him as a baby.
He's on the cross.
They love the idea of him being helpless.
Right, he's dead. Yeah, and of course he's a baby dependent on his mommy, because his mommy is the queen of heaven and the mother of God. She is Astarte. Yeah, it's just astonishing. So, you'd ask him, so can you tell me, since those are the two depictions that you have of your God, can God die? Did your God actually die?
No.
Did man kill your God? And, by the way, was your God born? Was your God born, 15 billion years after the creation was conceived?
Oh, the whole virgin story just kills me. It really does.
Oh, my. You know, whether
it's
or not...
It's the whole Semiramis story, like perfection.
Yes. Oh, you know, there is, and I think it's Roy that has shared this thought a number of times. And if it's not Roy, then I apologize. I should give credit for the person who shared this. It happens to be something that I'm not certain I agree with, but there's aspects of it I rather like. And that was that that Yosha, from the time that he was first conceived to the time he was 30 and the set-apart spirit came upon him in the Jordan River, that he wasn't a whole lot different than any other kid. Now, he had, Yahweh obviously was communicating with him much more vociferously, and he was much more open to listening to Yahweh speak. That's why he went into the synagogue and went to the temple and sought the ways of his father, and he knew who his father was. But he would have been prone to a lot of the same kinds of just drivel that we engage in, that he wasn't the perfect manifestation of Yah. And so
I think he drilled on his pillow, just like anyone else.
I think so, too. Yeah, he pooped in his pants. I mean, it's, absolutely. Yeah. So,
and when he was small, he helped his mother make bread. I'm sure of it.
But you know, it's there is every indication that it was only during those last 3 years that he was the literal word of Yahweh. And what's interesting too is that his style and persona, his attitude, is a perfect match for the God of the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, and a total and complete discord with the God of Christianity. You know, he was gruff. He was uncompromising.
Ooh, the money changers.
Yeah, he was argumentative.
It was the only time he ever got violent. And you can understand it now with what we're seeing coming out with what governments are doing to steal wealth from people.
Right.
It's funny how the Pope said just, 8 months back that wealth distribution needed to happen.
funny
how
everybody's but his.
Yeah, everybody's but his. Yeah, he doesn't want his.
His keeps growing. Yeah.
But yeah, his
money is evil. Send it to him.
There you go. Well, he's just, he happens to be a communist. But the fact is that
flaming communist.
Really, you know, if you get into that story, particularly as it's told through the eyes of Netanyahu, he doesn't like people very well. You know, the Sermon on the Mount is the longest conversation he had with people. And he was up there at the top talking down to them. That was the longest conversation, and he was up at the top of the mountain talking down to them. Longest conversation he had with humanity. Most of his conversations were very brief. And his conversations with rank-and-file individuals typically were, they would ask a question, and he'd say, why are you asking me that question? And he says, what does it say? How come you don't know the answer to that question? What does it say? And then, you know, they'd say something. He says, well, then do that. You know, when he met with the guys on the road to Emmaus, he said, you know, are you incapable of thinking? Why can't you understand this? Every time that he would engage with...
Joe Q Public right there.
Yeah, Joe Q Public. He would, after being confronted by people with their personal wish list. Okay, I want to be able to see. I want to be saved. I want to be able to walk. Heal my son. You know, typical humanity coming to God with their personal wish list. And Yosha's response was always the same. Listen, I'm going to deal with this for you, but only because if I can do this for you, which is meaningless, maybe you'll understand that I can do something for you if you listen to me that is meaningful. And then once he did it, he got away from them as quickly as he could. You don't see him.
Have the message repeated.
Right. Yeah, you do not see him walking into a large crowd of people and spending the day. Never once. You don't see him saying, you know what I think I'm going to do here today is we've had such a great time, people. It's been, you know, it's been swell. We're going to come back and we're going to do this tomorrow night. You know, get your seat early. And oh, by the way, when do you guys want to stay for dinner? Let's sit here and let's break bread together. No, as soon as he could, he walked away. And when he actually had a conversation with the leaders of that society, religious and political leaders, he was extraordinarily judgmental and condemning of them.
Sounds like every conversation I have with a religious Jew.
Right. It sounds like
it's scathing because you cannot jar them any other way.
Correct. Well, I don't think, I mean, it's my conclusion that the reason that he did not want to spend a lot of time with them is that he realized that even though he was the best communicator in the universe, even though he is the living manifestation of Yahweh's word, that even the most effective, flawless, perfect communicator was not going to resonate with the religious and political mindset of humanity. That there was
no, they were already flawless. What did they need him for?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, they. That's their filter. And he recognized that he was not going to succeed with the Romans because the Romans thought that they were bigger than God. He was not going to succeed with the religious Jews because, well, they were calling themselves Rab, after all, exalted, high, you know, mighty. He was not going to, and he knew it, that his testimony was not going to resonate with them. So why bother? So he didn't come.
No, he knew their cups were full. Full
right.
of
so, you know,
we all
wonder,
know.
You know. Right, so if you ever wonder why we don't have an accurate recap and testimony of what he said, it's because what he said didn't resonate. It didn't matter. It's not why he came. he knew that he was not going to be effective in communicating with them. That's why the only long speech we have, he says, you know, don't think I came to change anything in the Torah or the prophets. Not a word of it's going to change. Therefore, you don't need anything. You don't need to know anything he said from that point on, because he did not come to educate or to enlighten humanity.
I think the part where he said you're like serpents, like you're like your father.
Root
I think he really said, because you all you have to do is 5 minutes in a room full of Jews.
He only was here for a singular purpose, and that was to honor the promises that Yahweh had made to deliver the benefits of the covenant. Pesach, Matzah, Bukkurim, and Shavuah needed to be fulfilled. And since Yahweh is just, he could not be capricious and simply ignore what we have done that is wrong. There had to be a means to justly resolve those disputes, and Yahweh was going to do it by being the Passover lamb, by having his soul ransom us, by paying the price for our rebellion himself, and then leading the way for firstborn children, and then providing the Spirit to enrich and empower and enlighten us with the promise of seven on Shavuah. That is the only reason he came. And so the testimony of his disciples was essentially irrelevant. That's why we don't have a Hebrew account of it. We don't need it. There isn't anything that he said that we need to know. Nothing. It's what he did that we need to know. But where is the most accurate account of what happened on Pesach? If you want to read what happened on Pesach, he actually told you where to go.
Psalm 22.
Yeah.
Psalm 22.
That's why he explained it. He said, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was quoting the opening line from Psalm 22. It's the most graphic explanation of what was going to happen on Pesach and Matzah and Bukkurim. And
Yahweh came to open the door
again
for all humanity.
And Yeshayah 53, it's explained in Mizmor 88. And so
yeah.
It's explained, of course, in Kara. It's
explained practically in every part of the Torah.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah.
When they say they can't find him, I'm like, are you kidding? Are you blind? Well, yes.
Well, of course, his name, which I'm not even sure really is a name. I think it is a identity designation and a mission statement.
Yeah,
but
like a title.
If you wish to call it a name, you know, it's presented 222 times. I mean, so I don't know how you can say I can't find him. Well, there's 222 times that you can find him.
But they can, you know, they can tell you everything Maimonides say or anyone else. They can tell you that, but, you know. For me, Yom Kippur looks like, to me, now sitting in the position that I'm sitting in, and for a couple of years, if he came to open the door for humanity, not just Israel, but humanity. And Yahud, you know, they slammed the door shut and threw him down the stairs. And
you know
haven't looked back.
You know who educated Maimonides?
Oh, that was,
you know what language Maimonides wrote in?
Arabic.
Do you know who Maimonides served?
He was the doctor to the caliph, no?
No, in Egypt.
He was the doctor to the caliph. He was educated in Muslim Spain. That's where he was educated as a child. He then moved to Morocco, where he was further educated in Islam. And then he moved to Cairo. Where he served Muslim interests.
He was a well-rounded whore.
Maimonides with his 613 laws, the same number of seeds in a pomegranate. You think there really are 613 seeds in a pomegranate?
No, I actually counted. There's not. There's more or less, you know.
It's not even.
It's all a plan.
They don't even average anywhere close to 613.
Nope.
And of course, there are no laws in the Torah, much less 613 of them. And
how can you seize power if there's no law?
Of course, correct. Yeah, how can God be fearsome? Why does religion need to protect mankind from God unless God is fearsome? How is it possible that Torah can mean law when it's based, according to Yahweh, on the verb yara? Yara means to teach, to guide. Yeah, to direct. Yeah, how is that possible?
No. They are the guiders, the teachers, the directors.
Okay, all right. And then if you're going to have laws, does one learn from a law or does one obey a law?
You obey a law,
right?
Laws don't teach you anything. 65-mile-an-hour speed limit doesn't teach me anything. It's just something I have to do, or I'm going to be punished.
That is correct. So if it was a law, a set of laws, can you please cite the Hebrew word for obey, Lisa? I must know the Hebrew word for obey. In fact, Hebrew must have 20 different words for important concepts. I mean, almost every important concept in Hebrew, I mean, there are gazillions of words for it. So obey, if there's a law, obey has got to be the single most important concept in Hebrew. What is the word for obey in Hebrew?
There is none.
There is none.
Hey, I would ask another question, too. If God wants us to be religious, what's the Hebrew word for religion?
There is none.
Yeah. Let's go.
There is God has no religion. Not even yours. Not yours, not yours, not theirs.
No, there is no Hebrew word for religion. There is no Hebrew word for obey. How about this?
There is a Roman word for it. It means to bind.
Yes. Religion is based upon the Latin word, which means it's based upon the ligaments. It's a derivation of ligaments, the way we get ligaments, and ligaments bind our bones together. And so the word religion is from the Latin meaning to bind. And Yahweh does use Hebrew words that convey the concept of binding when he is condemning human institutions. The Hebrew word that is rendered prayer, palal, doesn't mean prayer.
No, it means to respond to.
Yeah.
And you can't talk to something and not have it respond if it's a living thing. Unless it's impaired in some way, deaf, dumb, and
stupid. Now, anah is the primary word for response. Palal is not the primary word for respond. It does have a respond aspect to it. Palal, primary meaning of palal is actually to think judgmentally. It's to judge in the sense of determining right from wrong. It is to meditate, to contemplate, to think, and that after considerable contemplation and analysis and understanding, and then respond. That's what palal means. And it's to petition in the sense of understanding that there are rights that have been afforded, and to thoughtfully respond based upon the rights that have been offered. What are the rights? The rights are to become immortal, to become perfect, to become adopted, to become enriched, to become empowered as part of the covenant. Those are the rights, and it all means to petition, to request those rights. So there really is
not only that. How many times do you think in Torah do you hear that phrase? Because I like to recognize patterns.
Right.
That Yahweh says, "Judge rightly."
Where he's asking us to be judgmental, to exercise good judgment.
All over the place. Judge rightly.
All over the place.
Over and over and over and over. Drill.
Yeah. One of his favorite words are yada, to know, and bien, to understand, constantly. And the means to knowing is the two verbs that he uses the most often relative to his testimony, shama and shamar. Shama, listen. Shamar, observe.
Well, I have to admit, for the first 2 years, I didn't have a proper Yom Kippur. I was still in the rabbinical, I don't know what to do, I don't know how to interpret this. And it wasn't until Larry and I had a discussion, and he shot me over some words, and I was studied them for half a day, ran to the store, bought some food and wine, and had a wonderful evening. Let me tell you, it was a huge relief from all this lamenting and horror, you know?
But I
think this year I finally understand Yom Kippur much more fully. And have such a richer and deeper understanding.
And so, you know, I shared at the beginning of the program my view of Yom Kippur, which is that we are celebrating in advance. Yahweh was promised year 6,000 on Yom Kippurim in year 6,000 Yah, his reconciliation with Yisrael and with Yahudah in Yisrael in Jerusalem, and that is what we are celebrating, and that we're speaking about it, we're encouraging it, we're announcing that it's going to occur, and we're going to be there as witnesses when it does occur. We're going to be in the bleachers watching it.
Yeah, and I have
occur.
To admit, I'm so relieved not to have to be the prodigal son.
Right. Yeah, you're going to be watching the prodigal son. Return.
Yes.
But you're going to, even though you are ethnically Yisrael, Yehudah, I think that that having come to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant well before your ethnic brothers and sisters, you're going to be up with us in the really good seats watching this transpire.
With a bag of Skittles. Yep. I'll be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to. And I think that the reason that there is no menu presented for this is that Yahweh himself is going to provide the feast.
Oh, yeah.
No, he's not coming back empty handed. He's going to provide the feast.
No, and that's why I think it's perfect that Jews starve themselves on Yom Kippur, because their first taste of real food is going to be at the king's table. I think
that's
perfect.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so your conclusions then sound like they're similar to my own, that this is what we're celebrating, is the reunion of Yahweh and Yisrael and Yehudah on this day, and that there's a reason that we are told in Zechariah, and it's repeated in Mattaniah, and I think here in Yashayah, that we are going to be essentially light, and we're going to be called from the four corners of the universe, where we've been out having a grand time while the tribulation winds down. But at this event, when Yahweh is returning to earth and is going to obliterate all traces of religion and celebrate his reconciliation with his family, we're going to be there.
Watching. Yes, and I'll be the girl wearing the stardust dress.
There you go.
Well, you know, even if we didn't have to be there, I don't know about you. I
maybe
want to be there for
my hair. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm going to have some bling, too. It might be a stardust vest, but you know.
And the
lamb
is
going to
be perfectly cooked, and the wine is going to be magnificent.
Yes.
It's going to be a beautiful thing.
It's going to be a beautiful thing. Music is going to be spectacular. The light show is going to be beyond imagination. And I think what we're going to be looking at that moment is the most beautiful home that you can possibly imagine, as a home comprised of light sitting on the top of Mount Moriah with this magnificent cascade of water coming out of the Mount of Olives, representing the cleansing and life-giving nature of the set-apart spirit. This gusher of light is going to come out of the Mount of Olives. That earthquake fault is going to absolutely consume the Alaska Mosque and
trash.
All of that trash and all of the religion of Constantine's mother and all of that yuck is going to be consumed. And this beautiful cascade of water is going to go through there. We're going to see Dodd in all of his magnificence leading the chorus, his home down there on the southern part of the ridge, and this beautiful bridge of light that's going to connect the two. And that's what we're going to be witnessing on this day. That's what Yashayah 2:2 is speaking of. And it's going to be an unbelievably glorious sight. And it says specifically of us, so then every goyim shall flow forth with joyful countenance, beaming with happiness, shining brightly over this. Darn right we're going to be. We're going
to
be glowing.
Yes, and their jaw's going to drop to the floor because they're going to party with Israelis.
That's right.
These people can party.
Because the Israelis that are there are all going to be covenant members. They're all family now.
Yes, but you've been to Israel, right? They don't stop. They go until like 7 in the morning. It's crazy.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Well, not going to... On this, it's going to start at 6:22 p.m. Jerusalem time, and it is going to be glorious because in the months prior to that, the sun has been you're not going to be able to see the sun. You won't be able to see the moon. The sky is completely filled with all sorts of debris. There's still the residue of the impact of Apophis. There is still the residue of the nuclear exchange of the northern hemisphere. There is still this massive amount of pollution in the air, and so it is. You know, 9 out of 10 people, maybe more, have died. The Earth is in complete and utter chaos, and it has been the most miserable 3.5 years. That's why we're going to be off exploring the universe and coming back in our party outfits, is that we don't want to see what's transpiring here on the Earth. But at this moment, when all of that darkness and gloom, all of that death and destruction, you have this magnificent light show of music and feast and reunion right there in
and singing and dancing and lamb and wine.
Yeah. And so that is what we're celebrating. And then we're going to be there for the 5 days that follow, because I think that that the reason there's 5 days between Yom Kippurim and Sukkah is there's really a lot of work to do. Now, could Yahweh just snap the proverbial fingers and cause the all religious artifacts and everything just to disappear and have the entire earth return to the conditions of the Garden of Eden? Yes, he could, but I think he wants us to have the opportunity to see him transform. And so those 5 days are all this renewal process, this transformation process.
I have another idea.
Yeah.
What if the people gather together to actually honor and revere, purely because the people that will be there love Yahweh.
Right.
That they take out their hammers and smash the idols. And perhaps it takes them 5 days to do it, but everyone's on board.
Yeah. You know, what if, I personally happen to like your idea.
Yeah, I like
better.
To work with people.
Yeah, that's right. I like your idea better because it's his style. You know, and if that is the case, and it fits Yahweh's style better than my depiction of he's going to show us and we get to watch.
And I'm going to help. I'm going to help you all that.
That we get to help. That being the case, then, which I think is a magnificent idea, then it is. It affirms what I said is going to happen 1,000 years later, that one of the two reasons that Yahweh is going to create a new universe is so that we can witness the creative act and learn from it so that we can then go off and be creative. But it might be also that your suggestion applies even to the creation of a new universe, that we may get to participate in it. He may say, hey, girl, and they start us dressed. What do you think we ought to do over here? Now, this is how I did it the last time. What do you think? You know, if I was sitting next to the girl and they started pressing, she was slow to respond. I said, anything but no chiggers, no mosquitoes.
Yes.
And none of those weird centipedes they have down here in the Carib Islands. Those things are very bad.
Yeah, we got some things. No snapping turtles, and no mosquitoes, no chiggers, and no really biting centipedes. Let's not include some of those things. And you know, if we're going to
I wouldn't mess with the dog. Though I think the dog is perfect.
Yeah, the dog is perfect. Let's not mess with the dog. But if we're going to have a platypus, let's go all out and give it wings.
Speaking of evolution,
I like that.
Here's something very odd I came across this week. Elephants in Africa are starting to genetically change and mate with tuskless males because we, of course, hunted them practically to extinction.
Yeah.
They're actually genetically changing spontaneously on their own. Isn't that wonderful?
Wow, because they recognize, of course, that the tusk causes them to die.
Yes.
The tusk is an invitation to
So the matriarchs are mating with tuskless elephants, and now there are 15% of the birds are tuskless elephants.
Yeah, you know,
life is intelligent.
Yeah, it is, and it has the Yahweh wrote in the DNA code the ability to do this, so that while we know that mutations, if according to the biologists, the kind of mutations that they think are part of natural selection would all be universally negative. They would be counterproductive. But Yahweh wrote into our DNA code the instructions that made these kinds of upward evolutions possible. And so I think that is truly a magnificent thing. I would like to speak, though, to the killing of elephants for their tusks, or rhinos for their tusks, or sharks for their fins. Killing for the sake of killing, being in the military, for example, and killing because your country tells you to kill. Killing for the sake of killing is one of the things that God hates the most. The one justification that Yahweh gave for the flood was that man had become vicious, a killing machine.
Mm-hmm.
God doesn't like it when we kill for the sake of killing. And to
perfect
to
example, Nimrod, Esau.
Yeah, of course.
Killer.
Mighty hunter. Right, he was a killer. He was a killer.
Yep.
Nimrod is killer. Muhammad, killer.
Killer. Right. Hatred.
Rabbi Akiba and their little band of
Rabbi
Akiba was
a killer. Yeah,
killers.
Rabbi Akiba, absolutely.
They all have that in common.
Right. Killer.
How was Tammuz killed?
You look at every human civilization.
Out on a hunt.
Deadly. Look at every human religion. They're deadly.
Mm.
They're killers. And that's the thing that Yahweh hates the most. Yahweh loves life.
Yes.
Life is his. You know, it's the universe is grand and it's big and it's beautiful and we're going to get to explore it. But the part of the universe that Yahweh wants to show off is life. And killing life just for the sake of killing. You know, it's one of the things that was when Yahweh was instructing Yehuda to be different than the Goyim as it relates to his feast. I did a little study. I learned, when Yahweh was talking about slaughtering the animal for the sacrifice, and I was trying to think of, you know, isn't that killing? No, because what happens 100% of the time with the Pesach lamb or any of the sacrificed animals?
Food.
They're eating, right? Right. And we are we're carnivore, aren't we?
Yes.
We're actually omnivore. But without protein, without protein, men and women are in sorry shape. And so we are an omnivore, but protein is an essential part of our diet. If you're killing an animal mercifully for the express purpose of food, God's got no issue with that. But I was looking, okay, what kind of sacrifices then were the Goyim making? And let's at the same time in Sumer, for example.
Yes.
And you know what they were sacrificing in Sumer? Humans.
Humans.
And we have absolute proof of that now. There are sites at the homes in the yards of homes of the chief priests and the kings in Sumer that have tens of thousands of sacrificial victims, all killed the same way: men, women, and children, all with sharp objects hammered into their skulls. They sacrificed.
I think there was a case of one Egyptian pharaoh who also buried a troop of his.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. But the Egyptians.
You know what all of the Babylonian temples had in common?
The Greeks sacrificed humans. The Carthaginians sacrificed humans.
It drives me crazy when I hear the people try and justify all the great Native Americans. You know, they were all peaceful Native Americans. Every single one of the Native American tribes pretty much participated in human sacrifice. Yeah,
but
the
ones that we have written records of where we actually know what they did, the Aztecs, the Mayans, and the Incas, their religion was predicated on human sacrifice.
Oh, yeah.
And so
and I think
the other religions, they weren't sacrificing animals, unless you look at man as an animal. They were sacrificing humans. And imagine a god that would want you to sacrifice a child. And what is Yahweh going to do when he sees someone that was religious that encourages that kind of thing?
Wait, did you say what about a god that would sacrifice a child? There is a god that does that today. That god is called the state. And he wants you to have an abortion. And many women do, even in Israel. It's shocking.
Yeah. It's the abortion is probably, in fact, I would think it's not even probably. I think it's the greatest killer in the Western world today. In fact, it's not just the Western world. I mean, you know what's interesting though about abortion? You know the difference between in the abortion rates per 1,000 women. And if half the world's countries abortion is illegal, half the world's countries abortion is legal. You know the difference in the rate of abortion in the legal versus illegal countries?
Almost minimum nothing, isn't it? Very little.
Nothing. Exactly the same. Yeah, there is. There is
no
difference.
Yeah, if you want an abortion here, you must go to another island. That's it.
Yeah, in the Caribbean.
Nothing else. Yeah, most of them just go to Miami.
Well, don't you think that the secular humanists today, who all agree, have all come to the conclusion that we have too many people on the planet, and most of them justify most of what they're doing when they kill off so much of humanity? What's the difference? I mean, for whatever reason they have, they've chosen that they're fine, we've got to kill a bunch of these people.
Yeah.
I have an idea.
Yeah,
with yourself.
Population control is a big, big issue with those people.
Yeah. You know, I have, there are the three individuals I love the most in this world are my two sons and my granddaughter. You know, are my children. My children. My children and my grandchild. I mean, I cannot imagine sacrificing them. And that's Yahweh's view. He loves his children. And he despises those who are hostile to them. He despises those who have misled them, who have harmed them, who would sacrifice them.
I don't understand how any woman can call themselves a feminist in the true sense of the word, and abort their own child. It makes no sense to me.
Oh, but there's feminism and abortion are the pro-choice. That's a huge part of it. But there's not a feminist in the world that is opposed to Islam. And you know, there's 250 million little girls, 500,000 in the United States, that have been sexually mutilated by their mothers. And there's not a single feminist that speaks out against it. Islamic women are forced to wear the veil the hijab, and yet there's not a feminist in the world that speaks out against it. It's just pure and total hypocrisy.
Feminists are more in line with political values than actual female rights.
Correct. Well, I think most feminists are feminists for the express reason of the personal elevation within the status of their culture.
Yeah.
The self-serving kinds of...
You don't want to know what I'll be silent on this. I have very negative views about these women that call themselves feminists. Scathing.
Yeah, I would love to hear that.
Yeah, just log on to my Facebook page. You can read all about it.
You know, it's... one of the things, of course, is really interesting is that the two most popular religions, Islam and Christianity, are hugely anti-women.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? That Islam, of course, exists
because he's anti-woman.
That they could own women. They could do whatever they wanted to men, to women. That men controlled women.
To
that was
lord
the appeal
over
of Islam. And then Paul, essentially said women have no rights. They shouldn't speak, and that men should lord over them. And some of his comments on women are absolutely reprehensible. And I'll stay in the home. If you were like, I want you to be like me and don't marry. But if you are going to marry, then control them, lord over them. Yeah, and don't let them speak. Don't let them do anything. Yeah, the two most popular religions are anti-women. Do you read any place in the Torah, Prophets, or Psalms where Yahweh says anything against women?
No.
No, he does use the word izar kinag, though. And
he does say that man shouldn't be alone, and that man needs woman.
Hey, how do you make a Hebrew word feminine?
Adonage.
Lisa?
Adonage, right?
What's God's name?
Yahweh.
What's at the end of it? What's at the end of it?
Hey.
The title of his treatise, Torah. What's at the end of it?
Hey.
The Torah.
Torah. Feminine,
okay.
Right?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So even Yahweh's name is a feminine name. You know, that was the reason with Yosha, even though Yosha is ends with the ain, not with the hey, but it's the same sound. You know why it became Iesus in Greek? It's because Yosha, having the ah ending,
sounded too feminine.
Name.
Yeah.
It's a girl's name.
Yeah.
Yeah, the girl's name. And in Greek, which is why they changed the name. They didn't want it to be a girl's name. The almost everything that happens in our world that has benefit, it comes by way of the Ruach. She is...
And to rule God.
Right.
And who collects us? Who do you think collects us from Teruah?
Right. Yeah. Oh, where we're asked to come into the feminine manifestation of Yahweh's nature. The feminine manifestation of Yahweh's light.
Yeah, our mom is coming to get us.
And coming into the presence of it. Yeah, it is feminine.
And taking us home, just like in a regular normal family.
I created them male and female. In my image, I created them. Yeah, Yahweh
I have
is,
a question, or maybe an idea.
Women. By the way, when Yahweh wanted to create the covenant, who did Abraham have to have a relationship with for Yishak to be born?
Pretty sure it was Sarah.
Sarah.
Yeah. And whose name sits in the heart of Sarah-El?
Sarah.
Yeah. Well, Yahweh has a has an affinity for women. It's why I think all of this idea that we have in puritanical Christianity, how there's this, you know, women can't have to be covered up. It's like Islam, they have to be covered up, and you can't look. Yahweh thinks women are beautiful.
I have something that kind of relates to that and the whole idea of being born again, because I kind of struggled with that.
Right.
The Ruach is both wind and related to water. And you have
right.
the Shamayim above, and the difference between almost like two different atmospheres, the
right.
way it's worded in Bereshit.
Right. Well,
and
of course, Shamayim is plural, because it not only speaks of the realm of the light of the stars, the realm of light, but it's also the spiritual realm. That's why I think it's plural. So it's the spiritual realm and the realm of the stars and of light. But yeah, it's always plural too.
Yeah. So my thought is that you know the door is through the sun, through
right.
the Lamb, and
right.
it's really kind of more like our for me interested in plasma in the universe and how it interrelates. And what is plasma? Plasma energy.
Matzah. I think matzah is also by way of the sun's sacrifice. You know, he is kind of the welcome mat where we scrape off the dirt prior to entering the doorway into Yah's home, and it's the dirty work that the sun had to do on our behalf. But Bukodim is a celebration of mom, of being born spiritually into Yah's family, being born of light. So. Bukodim, firstborn child, is certainly a celebration of mom, and Shavua, the promise of the Shabbat, is wholly and totally about being enlightened and enriched and empowered by our spiritual mother.
Okay, well, there's reference again to you know when the woman is in labor pains, you know when
uh-huh.
she's about to birth. I really think that is Yahweh's covenant family.
Yeah.
And I think the birthing is happening through the Shamayim. She comes to collect us, and we're off. We're
yeah.
going to the Father's house. That's it.
Oh, absolutely.
We're out of there.
On Teruah, when we are harvested, on Teruah, Yahweh's not returning on Teruah. So it's not Yahweh that's coming to get us. It's the set apart spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. Mama's coming home.
Mom's coming home to get her family. Yeah, mom's really protective.
Especially Jewish mothers, you know.
Interesting. My wife told me something the other day. She says, you know, there's been a study, and the study is that the intelligence gene is passed solely from mother to child, not from the father. The intelligence gene. Who is the source of our enlightenment? Mom.
Wow, that's
yeah.
astounding.
So there's a real difference between religion, where women are demeaned, and Yahweh's covenant relationship. Even Beres is a feminine word. Yahweh's family. His home is a feminine word. The set apart spirits coming together. Yahweh's name is a feminine name, even in Hebrew. You know, it's a celebration of the family, and the family is father, mother, and child, and we all contribute to the family. A family is not capable of celebrating life and living together without there being father, mother, and child. And that's the nature of the covenant. Well, we are officially out of time. But Lisa, you did a great job of filling in for the Larianator. I'm glad you called in.
You may have lost his job.
Well, I hope
you
grabbed the
yeah.
rum and had a hurricane party and everyone's safe and sound.
Yes, I hope
it gets kind of rough down here on these islands with all the rain. but
Jackson,
Florida's
Jackson,
on my mind.
Florida, because it's on the river there. I think it's called the St. John's River. I'm sorry, Yao Conan, that they have called you a saint. I apologize for that. But it was hammered the longest by this storm. And so it's I don't think it's going to be. I think that the islands off the coast of Georgia, and particularly the areas, those islands that near Savannah, are going to have the most destruction. I'm glad that he left Jacksonville. It was not a pleasant place to be.
I told him get out of there.
Yeah. You know where the home of U.S. military intelligence is? Where
Jacksonville.
United States military conducts
FBI
stores.
Department, Jacksonville.
Jacksonville, yeah.
That place is huge.
Yeah,
I don't think
absolutely.
I've ever seen American city
yeah,
so big.
Yeah, you want a place that needs
astounding.
To be hammered. Maybe that is Yazdia. Maybe it was right named correctly that Hurricane Matthew, Matanya, Yaz gift, is that he is hammering the very
did
place.
Did you see the satellite of the skull coming over? It was, wow, it was epic.
Really?
Is it still supposed to circle around and come back and hit Florida again?
Yeah, it is. It is supposed to circle around and come right back.
Ouch.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Right now,
well, we've got two more tropical depressions off the coast of Africa.
And if you look at the models
so.
Now, yeah, you'd have, all you would say is, who in the heck knows what's going to happen once it passes Wilmington? I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen with this storm.
Well, everyone stay dry over there.
Okay?
And take care of each other.
Hey, Lisa, you were wonderful. Thank you for participating. JB, thank you for finding her on
always
on whatever
a pleasure
line
with
you. Always. She called in on. Yeah, it was great stuff. Yeah. Had a good time tonight.
Oh, yeah. All
right.
All right.
Well, you guys
and,
have a wonderful
Larry,
night.
If you're listening, we hope you stay safe.
Yes, indeed.
We'll talk to you next week.
Yes.
Good night, everyone.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
See you guys next week.